free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine, and let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
All right, everybody, welcome once again to the show on this Wednesday, September 25th, 2013. Our guest today in a few minutes will be Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. More on him in just a minute. I want to remind you guys, my LibertyClassroom.com this week is having a special promotion, 60% off. To you guys who are new to the site and who are listening to this program, I'm very grateful to you. So 60% off with coupon code SHOW in all caps, and you can get a year's subscription. We've already got 8 courses up there you can listen to in your car. If you feel like you didn't get the real history and economics that you should have gotten, here's your chance. It's courses taught by me and by other people you may be familiar with. You're just going to love it. I keep saying you're going to feel like a kid in a candy store when you see all the stuff that's available at LibertyClassroom.com. I am never giving anything better than 60% off in the future, so take advantage of this and enjoy it. Also, check out TomWoods.com for all my events, because I've got some great things coming up. I've got dates between October and December that are going to take me to Las Vegas, Raleigh, North Carolina, the Cincinnati, Ohio area, and then the St. Louis and St. Charles, Missouri area, and then finally, probably in early December, I'll be up around the Spokane area for one or two speeches at law schools there. And then in early 2014, I'll be in Houston and in Grove City, Pennsylvania. So lots of fun things going on that front. Finally, let me mention that the show that you're listening to right now is not always on politics and economics and libertarianism, although 95% of the time it is. But once in a while, I just like to do something that interests me. I just like to talk about some topic that interests me. And today is one of those programs. You know, I'm 41 years old now. Now I'm getting old. Like, I used to be the youngster in all this, and now, you know, now I'm like twice the age of the average member of Young Americans for Liberty. Like, that's super disturbing to me, but that's okay. I feel the same, right? I feel like the same guy. But I mention this because I listen to stuff, people ask me what kind of music I listen to, I listen to stuff that's kind of old. I'll be honest with you, I listen to stuff that's old, but I listen to it because it's really good. I listen to really good stuff. I have good taste in music, let me tell you that, all right? I don't boast about a lot of things, but I do have good taste in music, and a lot of my listeners are younger folks who don't know about some of the stuff that I listen to, and so I feel like I have responsibility not only to talk Austrian economics, but also to spread the idea, just to spread music that makes the world better. It will like make your life better. You'll be happier in your life if you listen to some of the stuff that I recommend. And today, our guest is the longtime frontman of the band Jethro Tull, which has sold over 60 million albums worldwide. Jethro Tull was a person, but he died over 200 years ago. So the singer and the flute player in Jethro Tull is Ian Anderson, who will be joining us in just a minute. Now, that's right, he plays the flute, and yet he plays it in such a kick-you-know-what way that it works. It seriously works. He's an unbelievable player. And there's an album on which he plays the flute, the violin, the sopranino saxophone, the acoustic guitar, the mandolin, and the bouzouki. So this guy kind of knows what he's doing, and he's a rare bird in the rock world. He's intelligent. He writes great lyrics. The music changes like from every album. Like if you have one AC/DC album, you pretty much have them all. Once you have Back in Black, what else do you need really? But the interesting thing about Jethro Tull is that every album sounds different. Like Aqualung is different from Thick as a Brick, which is different from Passion Play, which is different from War Child, which is different from Minstrel in the Gallery, which is different from Broadsword and the Beast. Like, how do they do that? and yet each one you can tell it's them, and yet it's a completely different style. Always interesting, always exploring something new, very layered and textured, all kinds of different interesting instruments, very, very daring. In fact, two of their albums were just all one song. The whole album was just one song. And both those albums went to number one on the album charts in the U.S. I mean, that's unbelievable. That would never happen today. A 45-minute long song, and that's your album, that would never, wouldn't even chart today. And so I had a chance to meet Ian Anderson in Kansas City not long ago. I had written a really nice review of his show in Chicago, and his management company got in touch with me and said, hey, you know, we love your review. Next time Ian is in your neck of the woods, we'll get you after-show passes. And sure enough, my wife and I got to chat with Ian for about 20 minutes, and I asked him that. I said, what do you think has changed between 1972, 1973, and today that in those days you could issue an album that's all one song, 45 minutes long, very hard to play on the radio, and it hits number one, whereas today that would never happen? And he gave me an answer, but what I was trying to push him toward was people have gotten stupider. But he wasn't having any of that, unfortunately. That was where I was going. People have gotten stupider, they have no attention span, that's my theory. But anyway, we are talking to a guy who's an absolute legend. Every single compilation of the best or most influential rock albums of all time always, without exception, contains Aqualung by Jethro Tull. But there's so many other delightful pieces of music that you can encounter by just flipping through the Tull catalog almost at random, I would say. And so right now, it's a great pleasure to welcome to the program Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. Ian Anderson, thanks for taking a few minutes of your time to chat with us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Now, we have a fairly broad and diverse demographic here listening to the program, but at the same time, I would say we have an unusually large proportion of younger folks, and I've talked about people who were born in the 1990s, if you can believe that. So this might be a fresh demographic, and in fact, some of the folks listening probably are not familiar with Thick as a Brick, if you can believe it. So last year you celebrated the 40th anniversary of Thick as a Brick and then released Thick as a Brick Part 2, also in 2012. So can you tell us a little bit about what was Thick as a Brick, which hit number one on the album charts in 1972, and what's the premise behind the sequel?
Well, the original album in 1972 was an album generally thought by commentators of the time and now to be, a classic prog rock album, a progressive rock album, a concept album, and it came hot on the heels of an album called Aqualung, which became a very successful album for Jethro Tull. And when I wrote Aqualung, I was definitely not thinking about writing a concept album. It was a selection of songs, but in the way that you dress that up for public consumption and a vinyl record gatefold sleeve album cover, you try and draw things together to give it a sense of unity. And maybe I overdid that, because a lot of folks thought that Aqualung was a concept album. And in spite of the fact that I continued to say, no, it's just a bunch of songs. Three or four of them have something to do with each other, but most of them are unrelated to the others. So when it came to the following year, a follow-up album, I thought, right, let's give them the concept album they think I just made in 1971. Let's really go to town on it. So it was written as a bit of a parody of the prog rock genre and the concept album era, to the extent of my pretending that it was written, or lyrically, that it was based on the poetry of an eight-year-old schoolboy. And to present it very much as a continuous flow piece of music, which essentially was 20 minutes one side of a vinyl record and 20 minutes the other. So it caught the imagination of a lot of people at the time, and it was part parody, part serious. Essentially the meanderings of a precocious mind on the verge of puberty. I don't know if you remember that, but I certainly do, and things were a little confusing and became even more confusing for the next 4 years or so. But that's an important part of any child growing into physical adulthood. You know, you have a distorted view of the world around based on what parents tell you, what school teachers tell you, what you observe, and the way that you observe it from your own little world. So it was, in some ways, a little autobiographical, as most things I write are, to the tune of maybe 20%. Otherwise, based on a lot of other stuff around me, and so I try to see the world through the eyes of a prepubescent child grappling with the notion of making sense of the adult world. And 40 years later, after a long hiatus and several attempts by record companies and peer group musicians and fans and media to pressure to write a follow-up, a sequel, finally I came up with an idea at the end of 2010, and in early 2011 sat down to write that sequel based on the very simple idea of what might have happened to Gerald Bostock, the fictitious child poet. What might he be doing today? So I wrote down a list of 15 possibilities, whittled it down to 5, and started to write. And about 3 weeks later, I had an album.
Well, for what it's worth, it's my favorite album of yours since Stormwatch in the late 70s. It really demands the listener's attention. It's not just something to have on in the background. You've got to sit there and listen to it, listen to the lyrics, follow the story. The tour has been a great success, commercially, no doubt, but also critically. I've been very pleased to see that a lot of reviewers have said, I went to the concert knowing Thick as a Brick would be very good, but I had no idea how good the new material would be and how well it would translate to the stage. So that's got to be gratifying.
Yeah, I think that the moment when I started to write the album, though, I was very much trying to put something together with a lot of visual references and things that that I could do in terms of staging that would make it a performance piece. And so I was constantly relating back to the original Thick as a Brick and how that might be staged too, you know, what sort of visual imagery we could be using in terms of our video screen and additional performers and so on, the way that we present the show, it had to tie together. So, yeah, I very much wrote the album whilst all the time thinking about almost writing a performance, you know, writing a concert live performance, which I didn't do in detail, really, until after I'd finished the recording. But certainly in quite a lot of places, I had a fairly good idea how I was going to do the performance side of it, the actual stage production side of it, while I was writing, rehearsing, and recording the album. The detail came later when I sat down to write the show in the couple of weeks after I finished recording the album.
Now, you're currently on another leg of the tour. I attended a show on the first leg of the tour. I flew down to Chicago because I didn't know there was going to be a second leg, and I couldn't imagine missing performance of Thick as a Brick all the way through, which hadn't been done in 40 years. So where does the current leg of the tour take you?
Well, we revisit some areas that we've performed in the last year with Thick as a Brick in 2012. And so we're back into we have another couple of shows at the Beacon Theatre in New York City and start out on Long Island. Then we head off to Boston again. And then wend our way up to Canada and play Montreal, Toronto, Hamilton, Windsor, back into the U.S. for one show in south of Chicago, in Merrillville. And then we head off up to Winnipeg, where my wife particularly enjoys having a birthday. And so we spend a night off in Winnipeg. And then do a show there and cross Canada over to finish up in back in the USA in Tacoma.
We're talking to Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. JethroTull.com is the website. This is sort of an inside baseball question, but some of us are interested in it. How did you meet Stephen Wilson, who I think is one of the more underrated musicians out there, but of course he's a great producer and great technical guy as well. How did you meet him?
He was someone I got to hear about, really, because of his work in remixing one of the classic albums of King Crimson. And so as a remix engineer and producer in his own right of his own material under his own name and prior to that in the band that he founded some many years before, He was someone that known to me really for his remix work, and when EMI asked me about doing some 5.1 surround remixes of Aqualung and other albums, I suggested Stephen Wilson, and he was approached and did a couple of test bits, which he sent to me, and I thought he had a good approach, which was to keep very much the same layout in the stereo picture, to extend that into the surround sound world, and to keep the balance pretty much the same, but to technically clean things up, you know, have a much much more sparkly mix, because these days in the digital world you can dump all the background hiss and clatter from tape noise and the rumbly sort of things that are extraneous to the music that you couldn't help but record at the time. And so you can clean it up a lot in the digital world just by taking away the stuff that is not musical. And so we have a much clearer, more transparent mix. And Stephen is has a great respect for the original work, the original production, which of course was me producing and mixing the album. But to do that again now with his slightly younger ears, only slightly younger. Stephen Wilson is himself no spring chicken, but he's got ears that are, 15, 20 years younger than mine, so slightly more trustworthy when it comes to mixing. And so I asked him, in fact, when it came to having done Passion Play and Benefit and Aqualung and Thick as a Brick One, you know, all of that was work in progress, and so I asked him if he'd be interested in doing in the mixing of the Thick as a Brick 2 album, which indeed he did. And, so I spent many hours in Steam studio with him working on the remixes of those old and new albums. And, for the most part, I'm quite content to let him do most of it without me being in the room, because it's just, he sees it very much the same way as I do. I think he has a natural understanding, really, of a lot of elements of classic rock, not just my music, but other artists too. So, yeah, he's a good man.
You did an interview not long ago in which you were talking about Thick as a Brick 2, the current album, and you said something along the lines of, there has to be a place for thinking man's music. I thought that was an interesting remark. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's thinking person's music, because one of the nice things about Jethro Tull and work that I do under my own name is that it's kind of boy-girl out there in the audience. We've never been the band that appeal to a largely male audience. It's in most countries we play to, it's always been a mixed audience. And mixed also because of, when you actually look at the demographic, it is pretty broad, you know, people who are from all walks of life. And I'm really very happy that that's the case, because there are so many bands who, just do have the stereotypical kind of male black T-shirt, air-punching kind of audience who are just the rock and roll beer-drinking buddies. Luckily, it's not been that way for us. So I think it's something I've always wanted to perpetuate, was that you can make music which reaches a broad swathe of people on different levels. So, yes, there are elements of straight-ahead rock music there which appeal to the beer-drinking buddies, and there's a lot of music that, I suppose, appeals more to the sensitive and more feminine types. And that's just, I'm really just reflecting my own interest in music and my own interest in trying to reach across the musical genres and to embody all of that in a somewhat eclectic style. But, it's not meant to be overly challenging in an intellectual context, but I do like to think there's a little more depth and gratification to be got by listening to the music, reading the lyrics, and kind of going into the detail of what goes into making that kind of music and recording that kind of an album. But, you know, you don't want to make it too difficult. It has to be entertainment.
When you look over your whole catalog, what are you the proudest of?
I'm not on, you know, unwaveringly so, but here and there, I think I have a pretty good opinion of some of the lyrics that I've written. I've written some of the worst lyrics and some of the best lyrics in rock music, I think, when I look back on it, because I don't go where other people go, you know, and do it much better than I could do it anyway, because they've lived that life and perhaps can talk with authority. I try and deal with the stuff that means something to me, and it's just not usually... my lyric writing at its best is kind of out there. It's no one else uses those words, those constructions, those thoughts. I do feel that I've stamped my own kind of authority and individuality on rock music lyric writing when I've done it well. But I've done a whole bunch of stuff that look back on it and think, what on earth was in my head writing that? It's usually because I've been too self-consciously trying to write in a certain way. These days, I just let it flow. You know, I don't really analyze what I'm writing, and I don't set out to write it a certain way. I really just let it happen, and then begins the laborious process of editing, organizing, cutting, pasting, putting things into the finished and polished trim. But I do start off by just being a lot more confident, more relaxed in the way that I write things. So, yeah, lyric writing at its best is what defines me. And I suppose the other obvious thing that defines me is the guy who plays the flute in a rock band. And after all these years, I'm probably still the only person, internationally speaking, who's really known for doing that to, you know, to the level that it's given the flute a prominent role in the history of rock music.
Now, I want to let you run in a minute, although I appreciate your comments about your lyric writing, which I think is ridiculously underrated. Just what comes to mind is that wonderful little song Weathercock from Heavy Horses, which is just a beautiful ode, the sort of subject that wouldn't be taken up by anybody else. And from time to time on my website, when I'm trying to promote your stuff, I just quote the lyrics because it's beautiful and creative stuff. It's not just, a lot of times people say, oh, listen to the lyrics, they're so deep and they sound like a seventh grade poetry contest winner. But before I let you go, though, my 10-year-old daughter, Regina, is taking up the flute and she loves Ian Anderson. I'm sure she would love some parting words of wisdom from you. Have you any for her?
Well, it's always dangerous trying to impart words of wisdom to people, regardless of their age, but particularly scary when they're young people who are at that point of, I guess, wanting to distill a lot of confusing thoughts. But I suppose it would be that, you know, nothing in life is terribly easy, and it's the things. Well, it's actually summed up best by an ex-American president, by Kennedy, who said, having had his nose rubbed in it by the Ruskies when they not only got Sputnik into orbit before the Americans could do the same, but then managed to get Yuri Gagarin 51 years ago into space. And of course the big comeback was the promise to take America to the moon within 10 years, and Kennedy said something that has meant a lot to me over the years, which is we don't choose to go to the moon, I'm paraphrasing it, we don't choose to go to the moon because it's easy, we choose to go to the moon because it's hard. In other words, things that do seem daunting, do seem like an impossible challenge, are very often the things that really do drive people to excellence, to achievements. And he wasn't talking about himself. He was talking about thousands of people that had to be doing their best, had to achieve excellence to do what he had promised the American people he'd do in 10 years. Not that he was the guy there at the time, but, you know, that meant a great deal to me. And I suppose that's, in a way, carves out a good motto for life, doesn't it? To choose to do some things not because they're easy, but because they are hard, as he said in his Bostonian American accent, but is, you know, hard, difficult. And I think that's a good lesson to keep in mind. And it took Buzz and Neil to the moon, so it can't have been a bad thought.
Well, Ian Anderson, I can't tell you how grateful I am to you for taking the time with us today and for the tremendous catalog of extraordinary music you've given us over the years. And best of luck with the tour, and thanks so much again.
It's a great pleasure. Nice to talk to you. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
All right, everybody, that was the legendary Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. I have been a fan since, well, gee, that's, I guess over 25 years now I've been fan of Jethro Tull, and to get to talk to Ian Anderson is a real pleasure and a privilege. You guys should be listening to this guy. This is real music. Check out, let's see, what would I recommend? I'd recommend, if you're just jumping in for the first time, maybe War Child and Minstrel in the Gallery and Songs from the Wood. Get you started there. Or if you really, really want to dive right into the Tull sound, I'd go check out Bursting Out, which is a fantastic live album. And I'm pretty sure you can get all these things on Amazon or however you guys get your music these days. But anyway, my thanks to Ian Anderson and to all you guys for listening in today once again on the Tom Woods Show. And tomorrow, I believe I am talking to Lou Rockwell. So we're going to have a lot of fun talking about, well, how you get started from nothing and you build up an incredible Mises Institute that is responsible for educating a whole generation of people in Austrian economics. So there'll be much to talk about there. Any questions that you'd like me to ask Lou, tweet them at Thomas E. Woods. Check me out at tomwoods.com. And don't forget libertyclassroom.com with the coupon code SHOW in all caps, and you get 60% off just during this trial period. I sure appreciate you guys listening in. Please help me spread the word about the show, and we'll see you tomorrow. Take care, everybody.
The Tom Woods Show.